You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In the past couple of years, there has been a tidal wave of warnings that the world cannot feed the extra 3 billion people expected in the next decades. In fact, with the impacts of climate change, we may not be able to feed the current population, which we're doing a pretty poor job at as it is. We are not talking about hippie bloggers who say this. Many voices of worry come from people like Greg Page, the conservative executive chairman of the Cargill food empire, from investment advisors like Jeremy Grantham, and from the Pentagon. That means it is time to talk with the scientists about what we know and what we don't when it comes to climate change and food stress. It will take a series of interviews and programs to do it. We start this week with new science about climate and the stagnation of food production in the heavily populated European Union. Our guest is Frances C. Moore. She's close to a PhD at Stanford while working with the MacArthur Genius Award-winning scientist David B. Lobel. Frances is the lead author in two key parts of the puzzle. In 2014, she and Lobel published a letter about the ability of European farmers to adapt to shocks brought on by climate change. At the start of 2015, Moore was the lead author of a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy titled "The Fingerprint of Climate Trends on European Crop Yields." So, we have lots to talk about. Frances Moore, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with your most recent paper about the fingerprint of climate change on Europe's crop yields. First of all, is there a problem with European crop production?
Well, so a lot of that kind of depends on exactly what you mean by problem. So on the one hand, the yields of important crops like wheat and barley are, you know, very high in Europe. They're among the highest in the world. But on the other hand, the yields also stopped growing around the early to mid-1990s. And so there's lots of possible explanations for why you saw this decline in the rate of yield growth. And so what we're trying to do in this paper is to tease out the effect of climate change.
It seems obvious that heat waves, drought, unusual rains will take their toll in farmers' fields. Why do we need to do the science to prove climate is a factor?
Yeah, so you know, you would expect climate to have an effect, but what you might expect is that it has a different effect in different places. So warmer temperatures might be more damaging in regions where it's already warm. And so what we're doing here is, we are showing that climate change is a factor, but we're also quantifying the magnitude of that climate change effect and showing where it's had the biggest impact.
Before we get to your results, I would like to try to understand the methods you and Lobel used. In the abstract, you write, quote, "We show that statistical power for the identification of climate change impacts is high in many settings, but that power for identifying adaptation is almost always low." That has two parts. How can you use statistics to know if climate change is responsible for changes in the European growing conditions?
Yes, so in order to determine whether changes in climate have had an effect on European agriculture, what we're using is the fact that temperature and rainfall changes haven't been the same across Europe. So some areas have warmed faster than others, and in addition, some regions have experienced a drying trend while others have gotten a little wetter. So we'd expect the impacts on crops to kind of vary spatially as a function of these different trends. So you can think of this as what we call the distinctive fingerprint of a changing climate on crop yields. And so we then compare this characteristic fingerprint against how yields actually change. And what we're finding is that they are statistically related. So that's how we come to this conclusion that climate change has affected crop yields in Europe.
In the second part, you say statistics don't work as well to see how farmers adapt to the new challenges. Why not?
Yeah, so in this case, figuring out adaptation is harder because what we're trying to compare is how yields should have changed if farmers were adapting with how they might have changed if they weren't adapting. And it turns out that those things aren't all that different. So that means the signal is pretty small. And then the noise in yield trends, so that there's all this unexplained variability in how yields are changing over time, is actually really large. And so the signal-to-noise ratio is just too small. And so we can't look at yields and tell whether or not farmers are adapting.
All right. Now, from this paper, what can we say about the impact of climate change on European crops?
Yeah, so what we find is that long-term climate trends have affected crop yields in Europe, but there's been very different impacts in different parts. So warmer and wetter growing seasons have generally been beneficial in Northern Europe, while warmer and drier conditions have been harmful in Southern Europe. So in aggregate, these effects balance out somewhat. So the overall effects are fairly small. So we've seen small benefits to maize and sugar beet yields, and small declines of around 3 to 4% for wheat and barley yields. And so this is since 1989. So what this means is this can explain about 10% of the decline in yield growth rates, but really not the majority of it.
10%, that's not a lot for climate. What are some of the other factors, briefly?
Yeah, so it's definitely not the major part of the yield stagnation. And so we can't, say for sure what's causing the rest, but the ideas that are out there is that a lot of this has to do with major reforms to European farm subsidies over this time period. And in addition, the use of fertilizer has been more tightly regulated. And then it's also been hypothesized that there are these genetic limits to yield growth beyond which it's just technically impossible to improve yields. And the idea that Europe, kind of European, particularly wheat, might be approaching some of those limits.
Can we say with scientific certainty that the impacts of climate change on European agriculture will grow in the coming decades? And if so, what sort of changes would we expect?
Yes, well, I think you'll definitely see the signal of a changing climate, which we're already able to statistically identify in this paper. We'll certainly see it grow in coming decades as climate change progresses. And so what we know is that it's going to get hotter. And we know that wheat and barley in Europe seem to be particularly sensitive to warmer temperatures. So I think we'd expect to see yields of these crops grow more slowly or even start to decline as temperature increases.
Francis, do you happen to know the capacity of Europe to feed itself? In other words, if European crops are stagnating, even as the population grows, that rich continent will just import more food from other poorer countries. Are EU food imports growing, and is that an expected adaptation to climate change, perhaps?
Well, so Europe actually has a very productive agricultural sector at the moment, and it's actually an important exporter of wheat. So many countries in Europe, and in addition, you know, a lot of countries in Europe have a stable or even declining population. So the population growth is not necessarily a major concern. But I think what we worry more about is the idea that declining production might reduce the exports coming from Europe. And that could have a knock-on effect on global food prices. And that's very damaging for poorer consumers in developing countries.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Francis C. Moore from the Stanford School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences in California, and we're talking about Europe and how it feeds itself in the coming decades of climate change. Last year, you and David Lobel published a letter in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is Adaptation Potential of European Agriculture in Response to Climate Change. How can we know what such a large number of diverse private farmers are doing in response to changes pushed by climate pressure?
Yeah, so in this paper, what we're looking at is what farmers could do in the future as climate change progresses in order to adapt to those changes. And so the way we estimate this is by comparing farmers in different locations. So a farmer in Spain knows that on average it's going to be hotter than, say, in Germany. So he should have made all these adjustments and investments so that he's getting the most he can out of farming in this hotter environment. And so if in the future the climate in Germany becomes similar to that in Spain, then it's likely this German farmer is going to try to make these same changes. And so by looking at this relation across spaces, this is how we quantify the potential effectiveness of adaptation.
And you talk about short-term and long-term adaptation by European farmers. And I found this very interesting. You said it's possible farmers could regard climate change like superstorms or heat waves or floods just as unusual weather. And if they do that and don't form a long-term plan, what happens?
Yeah, so this is what we call the short-run response function or the response to climate change that doesn't include adaptation. You can think of that as farmers just responding as though climate change is unusual weather. And what we find is this results in an almost universally negative response across Europe. So even northern areas in cooler parts of Europe that we might expect to benefit from warming could see yield declines if farmers aren't adapting.
Yeah, your letter makes an unusual statement that, quote, overall profits could increase slightly under climate change. That's sort of the opposite of what we've been hearing from other sources. How could that happen?
Yeah, so when we're looking at profits rather than yield, what we're implicitly accounting for is that farmers have the opportunity to switch what they grow in response to climate change. So if you allow for the fact that farmers can make these adjustments, then the average effects across Europe may be very slightly positive. But you know, don't forget, this is a mean effect, and so this average disguises the fact that there might be big differences across Europe. So farmers in the south are likely to lose out, whereas those in the north might benefit, even if they're able to adapt pretty well and to adjust what they grow.
And you talked about the possible barriers, say, with wheat, and I'm wondering whether, if they can't adapt the staple crops that are currently grown to a hotter or wetter climate, maybe they might have to plant something else or even abandon farming in some areas.
Yeah, that was, I think, a pretty surprising result from this work, is that the adaptation potential for wheat and barley seems to be fairly low. And so there's a couple possible, you know, responses to this. One is that, well, farmers of those crops might just move out of those crops and into slightly more heat-tolerant crops like maize as the climate warms. Another response might be to see this as an opportunity to invest now in research and development to start trying to develop some more heat-tolerant varieties to give farmers more adaptation options to keep farming wheat as the climate warms.
And I read through the reports of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to see what's projected for Europe. And their projections have been optimistic generally compared to the rate of climate change we've already seen. So what is your overall view of what will happen to European agriculture, say, by 2040? Is it a dark picture, or are we going to be all right?
I think a lot depends on this question of how quickly farmers are going to be able to adjust and adaptive changes that we're going to see. And I think that's something we still don't have a particularly good estimate of. So if farmers are going to be able to adjust, then I think you'll see the distribution of crops that are being grown change over time. As I mentioned, perhaps more farmers switching away from wheat and barley and towards maize, which tends to do better in warmer conditions. And I think where water is available, you might also start to see increasing adoption of irrigation. What irrigation does, it helps reduce the adverse effect of high temperatures, but it also helps manage increasing rainfall variability that we expect to see with climate change. But if farmers aren't able to adapt quickly, then what you might see is more years of bad production, as well as possibly more variable production. And this could have a knock-on effect on the European grain exports and therefore on food prices, which is certainly detrimental to poor consumers around the world.
I noticed your research partner David Lobel published a paper finding that climate stress is linked to civil war in Africa. I guess if, as you say, Europe is not able to export as much food, that might be a further stress that could lead to conflict.
There are definitely a few papers now, David's work, but also people like Marshall Burke and Sol Fiang, who have published on this question. And they do seem to show a fairly robust relationship between high temperatures and increasing civil conflict. But what these papers don't really tell us is why you see this relationship. So what are the mechanisms that's driving this? And a possible cause is certainly through food prices. And it does seem to be the case that higher food prices are related to instances of civil unrest. And as an example, you saw this in 2007, 2008, where you saw a big spike in food prices that drove rioting in many areas of the world. So to the extent that adverse agricultural production in Europe is related to higher food prices, that could well be related to increased risk of civil conflict.
Why did you choose to study agriculture in Europe instead of the United States?
So that's interesting. So I went into this work looking for, trying to understand how farmers adapt to climate change. And what's interesting about Europe is that it's already seen fairly large magnitude of warming during the growing season. And so this is kind of in contrast to parts of the Midwest, you know, and the Corn Belt, which actually have this warming hole. So during the growing season, the warming trends have been very weak, if not slightly negative. And so there was not necessarily a great place to be looking for evidence of adaptation to climate change. And then in addition, in Europe, you've seen the stagnation of the important cereals, so wheat and barley. There was this hypothesis out there that's been driven by climate change. So both those reasons make this an interesting area to study.
Can you tell us, Francis, where your research is likely to go next?
Yeah, what I'd really like to do is use these maps of the climate change impacts to actually identify places to go and start talking to farmers. So in particular, we see areas of northern Italy seem to have been particularly badly hit by a combination of warming and drying trends. What I'd really like to do is go to Italy and start talking to farmers and to ask them, does this make sense to them? You know, have they experienced these yield trends? Have they noticed an effect on yield? And are they adapting to these trends?
And finally, I worry that scientific research into the impacts of climate change on agriculture are behind the rapid-moving facts on the ground. Can't we get enough science to policymakers and the agricultural industry in time to avert a really serious food crisis in the future?
I think climate change is definitely serious, but it's also, you know, one of only a number of challenges to the global food system over the next few decades. You know, also science doesn't necessarily have all the answers to these problems. I think many of these are political decisions that perhaps can be informed by science, but, you know, really need to also be made by an informed citizenry, kind of engaged with an elected representative.
We've been speaking with one of the bright young minds at Stanford University in California. Francis C. Moore is with the Stanford School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences. You can find links to the papers we've discussed in this program in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Francis, thank you so much for sharing your time and your mind with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. We've burned through all the time there is. Check out all our past shows as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org or find Radio EcoShock on SoundCloud. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.